Episode 31. This is the podcast that takes a core group of people as lovers, fans, and students of music and art, certain artists, songs, and albums, and we navigate how they help define moments in our lives, help shape understandings of our experiences, and help us understand the world around us. Music also may invoke memories of a loved one or a group of people in a particular moment. But you knew that already, didn't you? This week, the music and life of the Detroit-born and raised multi-instrumentalist producer Lorenzo Ferguson, known to all of us as Zo, with an exclamation mark, so get excited when you say his name. He brings back the deep soul music from generations past, and we deep dive into his 10,000-hour journey from grinding in early 2000 to his latest body of work, Forefront. Hey, listen, guys, check out bedroombeethovens.com. There you'll find an Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and most importantly, the Patreon. I do this for free, and your tiny contributions and support make sure the ship keeps going. You can donate as little as $2. And hey, let's be real. My freaking self-esteem goes up. Can you imagine doing this podcast and no one listens to it? Yo, I do this for you. Zo, he makes music for his fans. We're in the business of creating audio for others. So in the illustrious words of Steve Harvey, show your love. I'm your host, Cello, and
it's the Bedroom Beethoven Podcast.
Yeah, man. At first, I was surprised you answered your own email and fast too. But then I realized, oh yeah, man, he's the webmaster. He's the tour manager. He wears all of the hats.
Oh man, yeah, man. It gets hectic, man. And I, you know, sometimes like I made a joke one time on I think it was on Facebook where it was like, yo, if it's not in my calendar, then I'm going to forget. Because I'm, you know what I mean? Like I'm at the age where I'm like spread too thin, you know, that's just on the music side. Then you got the family side, which is like, you know, I got a daughter. So it's like, you know, you gotta keep everything written down, literally.
I mean, I was going to fight you on the time to record this interview because I honestly see how busy you are. And part of me just wants you to go to bed at a decent hour and get 12 solid hours of sleep.
Man, I'm on 2 hours 45 right now.
Well, I mean, as you know, as someone who does the majority of his own stuff, it must be cool to check your inbox and see an opportunity rather than have to chase something down. But on the flip side, I'm sure you have no shortage of people clamoring for an hour of your time. So thanks for, you know, deeming my platform worthy and joining me.
For sure. Yeah, no problem, man.
I know you're in work mode. You know, you're touring. I was curious if most of the time you'll come home and maybe you'll work on some music or try to go through your schedule and see what needs to be done for the week. But, you know, what do you do to unwind? Because, you know, are you more of a, you know, let's go to the museum or a park with my daughter and be around a lot of people? Or because you perform so much and you collab so much, maybe you keep it low key?
Very much low key. I'm you know. You know, turn on Netflix, turn on Amazon Prime, lay down, you know, try to hit the gym or, you know, take an hour long walk and, you know, just unwind that way. Like I, as an adult, like I really appreciate quiet and the art of silence. Like it's incredible.
Oh yeah. Me and my wife and my daughter, we take like hour long walks in the evening and that's like, man, we might as well be at Six Flags. For an adult, that's like the Mecca, you know?
Absolutely.
I take great comfort knowing that there are parallels between us. I took piano lessons at 6 and I hated it. Right now I am a graphic designer, so I think there are some things we're going to be familiar with as we talk. But the only difference, obviously, is I took a more traditional lifestyle approach, and you turned into this giant talent who has fans and a really great musical body of work. But I'm interested in that fork in the road. You know, I went left, you went right. You know, what was that moment?
The first moment was baseball ending. In 2000, you know, I was drafted to play pro baseball by Toronto Blue Jays in 96 and ended up going to Western Kentucky University on a full ride to play ball. It didn't work out to where, you know, I got drafted again. So once baseball ended, that passion basically kind of transferred into music. Music was something that I always did, something that I always loved, something that was always around me in the house that I grew up in. You know, my parents never had any real restrictions on me playing their records or their tapes. So, you know, it was something that, you know, they provided, but I could also explore on my own. And I think with that, like, you know, I kind of developed a love for it that I, you know, didn't even realize I had. Until took their records and then, you know, discovered that their records were like the basis of hip hop. You know what I mean? And I was definitely a hip hop fanatic. And then, you know, I started discovering samples, which, you know, then created another monster. You know, it kind of grew on from there. You know, you take that and you combine them with the piano lessons and the theory that I kind of picked up, even though I hated it. I hated going to piano lessons. I hated, you know, as a 6-year-old, I mean, 6-7 year old, you know, you hate sitting down and doing anything anyway. So, you know, you're always wanting to run around and be outside and play tag and, you know, play sports and, you know, be with your friends. And, you know, for moms to come outside and pull me inside to practice piano, like that was to me the worst thing in the world. So, you know, I'm just glad I was able to stick around long enough to catch theory and, you know, with sports and music, it is always a very much a parallel between those two disciplines, between the practice, between what you need to do daily, you know, and the, you know, just having to have that passion toward both of those. You know, I feel like it's the same vein. It's very much the same vein.
It must have been a weird dichotomy because you're enjoying your parents' records, but then you hate like playing music yourself. Because at 6, you're not thinking like, yeah, I have to master my craft. It's more of like, I'm doing this because my parents are telling me to do it.
Exactly. So it's kind of a rebellious thing. It's also just a, you know, 6-year-old attention thing. You know, it really didn't catch on to me until I was about 11. And that's when I started learning how to play by ear. And once I learned how to play by ear and, you know, learning songs that, you know, that I liked. And then it kind of took on a life of its own. And when, you know, when I taught music in a classroom, like that's what I did. Like I was like, okay, well, so we're going to learn to play, but we're going to learn to play stuff that y'all would like to play and applying theory to modern day stuff instead of, you know, going back into the box and the Gershwins and, you know, these classic composers, like let's apply theory to stuff that you can easily get to on the radio.
Yeah, no doubt.
And maybe it'll catch on a little bit quicker.
Well, when I say I'm a big fan of your music, you know I'm genuine because I've already interviewed Nicolay, tall black guy, stopped by a couple months ago. Word up. The people you surround yourself with, you know, so it's all genuine. In fact, he mentioned that all the programming and percussion on y'all's track, you did it in one take.
Yes. that was a one take joint on Step Up Front. Yep.
I mean, if you worked on the album for a year and you're getting stuff done in one take, that has to be a testament to how well you work with someone.
And the thing was, is that, I mean, he and I at that point were probably 2 weeks into working together, if that.
I was even telling him like how I used to live in Rockville, and I know you guys are kind of in the same,
yep,
the same area. You know, I was in Rockville for 2 months, or I think it was 3 months. But guess what? It was around the same time that you released Sunstorm, like 9-10 years ago, when that really insane winter storm hit.
Yes,
I'm from Texas,
yeah.
So I've never seen snow in my life until then. And I didn't know the severity of what ice and snow on the road can do to someone. So I ventured out of my apartment. I went to the grocery store and there were just car accidents everywhere. There were cars in ditches, abandoned. Like,
was there anything in the grocery store? I remember going to the grocery store because it was like right across the street. Was there anything in there?
There was no people, but there was things in there. I think people attempted and they had to like leave their cars on the street.
Yeah, man. I remember that. That may have been the worst I've seen, and I'm from Detroit. So that was bad. Like, that was horrible. I mean, wasn't that the one that was like 27 inches?
Yeah, and that was my introduction to the East Coast. Like, right. And that was it. And I promptly went back to Texas.
I don't blame you after that one. That one was bad. That was a bad one.
Well, let me ask you this. Your situation, it works for you, but on paper, and in regards of being independent, on paper, is it advantageous? Because if I'm Drake, if I have a machine behind me, if I have a manager, a publicist, a design agency, why should I handle my own business? Because if I have all that stuff taken care of, can I spend more time on the music, or it doesn't work that way?
I mean, at this point in my career, I wouldn't mind having a machine, to be honest with you. That way I can kind of, as you say, you know, get to the creative part and just kind of let other people handle those duties. At this point, I'm just like, yo, man, take this percentage on the back end and you know, let me concentrate on other stuff. Cause I mean, I'm tired, man.
Well, I mean, if you've been following the De La situation, them not being independent, they had to release a statement asking fans not to stream their music since they're going to see no revenue. I mean, how heartbreaking is it for an artist to tell people not to listen to your entire catalog of music?
That situation is ridiculous.
That's not the norm, I guess.
Yeah, no, that situation is totally ridiculous. You know, De La was very much a staple at Tommy Boy Records and, you know, a huge part of them having, you know, the visibility that they did at that particular time. I would think that they would, you know, kind of be forgiving and, you know, in that situation and let those guys who are living legends, you know, own their masters, or at least own a percentage, you know, of that material. Yeah, that situation is totally ridiculous. And, you know, Q-Tip said it 30 some years ago to, you know, the industry rule number 4080. I mean, that's it's incredible, man. You know, when you go to the indie side, the huge pro is that you do own your own shit, and you're also able to make what you want whenever you want, put it out whenever you want on whatever platform in present day time. You know, there's so much freedom, which leads to so much music coming out that a lot of us can't, you know, I know I can't keep up, like, you know, trying to be creative and trying to keep up with what's new and, you know, what's fresh. And, you know, that's difficult to do. Fonte is really, really good at that. Like, he has his ear to all the streets. You know, I kind of get the trickle down from him, but it's difficult, man. But as an independent artist, like, that is absolutely the pro. With that, you know, not being handcuffed, and they're totally being handcuffed, and it doesn't matter that they're living legends with, you know, an incredible discography, who are still out here, you know, killing shows, and, you know, are in a lot of people's top fives as far as groups go. None of that matters, and that's, you know, that's ridiculous, man. That's ridiculous.
Well, you said something that caught my attention in a previous interview. You said if you develop a solid work ethic, at the end of the day, no one can take that away from you. And I have to say, I almost kind of disagree with that, because let's say you start out grinding the way you were, and now you made it, and now you kind of want that machine. But if you don't want to be an independent musician and you rely on other people, admittedly, you don't need to be as disciplined, because, you know, as disciplined as someone who wants to remain independent, because you have to rely on A&Rs, managers, publicists, designers, bookers. That work ethic muscle is going to dystrophy. Would I be out of line if I hinted that part of you remained independent so you didn't lose that edge?
Kind of, sort of. And it's also because I got trust issues. you know, a lot of the time, like, I am very particular about, I guess, who I deal with and, you know, who I, you know, hand off a duty to and all that stuff. Like, I'm still kind of like I guess I just got to humble myself and just say I'm kind of a control freak when it comes to that type of thing. And that's just because, you know, I'm always the dude where I'm like, you know, I don't see anybody going as hard as I do. So or you know, or it's tough to find that person. And I think I've found some people who are like that in the past, and they're usually busy with other artists. I think I've got a couple great people in my corner now who are you know, helping out, you know, particularly with booking, like, you know, like Empire. And that's been a huge help, man, because, you know, a lot of that stuff, you know, I'm, you know, I don't really want to negotiate anymore. Like, I'm cool on that right now. You know, I'm just in that stage. But yeah, I would say that I kept it independent, particularly on the business side, because of the control and because I want to see everything, and, you know, because I want to know who's touching what, when, and how much of a cut it is, and, you know, what's my cut going to be. I need to see all that. And, you know, I think that's one of the main reasons why I remain that way.
So, I mean, from my observation, it has nothing to do with, like, you know, I'm a huge fan of Overdue Process, but I've noticed Asylum 7, he hasn't released an album since you guys released an album. And the same with, like, Darian Brockington.
It's been 6 months since I held you, babe, and I've been in hell, just trying to find a substitute when I know too well that you're the only woman in the world.
It's been like a decade since he released something, and I was starting to get real worried about you guys, but maybe it has something to do with that. Like, maybe the work ethic isn't matching yours, and I don't know, maybe that's a reach.
No, I mean, I know with D-Brock, he had gone and you know, was starting to work in the gospel field. With A7, he started picking up bass guitar. You know, just wanted to move more into a musical lane, and I think at one point he was playing with a band, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, I guess the one obvious thing as an independent artist that always becomes an issue is, you know, the monetary payoff. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you got to get a 9-to-5 to help. For some people, that's their machine. You take the money from your 9-to-5 and you reinvest it in your music career or whatever you happen to do. So, you know, you kind of start seeing that. I mean, the bills and rent and mortgage, all that shit don't stop, man. So, you know, you gotta try to find a way sometimes.
That's true. And, you know, even in the last calendar year, a lot's happened where you were opening up for Kamasi Washington. Now he's opening up for Herbie Hancock. And it's crazy how 50 years into his career, how close your genre of, like, R&B soul music is to jazz. It's taken this long, even though there's a jazz component within soul music, whereas jazz is born of the blues.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, I love that. You even got a little mint condition on the album. I remember my first job out of college was making a tour flyer for them. And I remember I asked my boss, like, is this a local band? And he just, like, looked at me like I was just the dumbest person on the planet. He's like, man, these people have been around since before you were born. So I had to do my research on that.
Yeah. Now that feature was crazy. I mean, that was a Fonte thing. Fonte reached out to Stokely for that one. And I would just say that once Stokely sent us back that track, it knocked two other songs off the album, and we were pretty much finished at that point.
That's yeah. And what I found so interesting is how long it took him to kind of embark outside of that group. You know, I'm really glad that he was able to dig deeper into his sensibilities and explore a lot more, because it can be hard to step into the solo light because you're able to sign your name a little bit bigger. And also with a group, you leave room for democracy. With just one person, you just do all the things you love instead of cutting up portions of yourself. So the fact that he's featured on your album, that's a real love letter. That must have been really great to work together.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was fun for me to hear him over production of mine and, you know, stuff that, that Fonte had written for him. So it was like, you know, it was one, it was a dream. I mean, that was a dream come true. Cause I mean, you know, I've been listening to Stokely since 91. So, you know, this is a guy that I basically grew up off of and, you know, to have him on an album of mine, like that was just absolutely crazy just in and of itself. And, you know, he came in and put on the damn vocal clinic. So, you know, it's just what he does, and he makes it seem effortless. And, you know, as soon as I get to, you know, thinking I can hold a tune, here he comes with sweat and just sitting everybody down.
It's funny. I was going through the track list today, and I swear this happened. I saw Madison McFerrin, and I leaned back in my chair, and I said, I bet you that's the daughter of Bobby McFerrin. That's something he would do. I guarantee it. And sure enough.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Questlove described her as like Sol Appella. And, you know, I just think, you know, her vocals over your production, it's peanut butter and jelly. It was a good track.
It was really dope, man. That was another Fonte connection, man. She and he got together. It's maybe like over a course of maybe 2 or 3 days. It was really dope to hear her voice over two totally contrasting styles of music.
To try and listen, 'cause I might not know what to say. Selfishly, I'm worried.
Song where, you know, she sounds like really just it's like a late 50s early 60s kind of feel where she sounds like really somber over the joint. But I mean she's, her voice is thick, man, and you know, I love it. I love the texture, especially for her to be so young, man. I love it.
Oh, and she's like mid late 20s, probably, just kind of, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's amazing. I love the meld of the two worlds. I know you got two projects coming out at once, and what a lot of people don't realize is the time Luke Sherman showcased some songs that were intended for Forefront and it ended up being on Showcase.
Right.
So, that was pretty tricky as well.
Now, that was crazy, man, because Time Loop was actually probably about the second instrumental that I did that was intended for Forefront. And, you know, Tay hit me up and was like, yo, man, you know, they're looking for these 80 sounding joints, or, you know, let's send it to them and, you know, let's get the stuff out now. Like, we're doing the music now, so let's get it out. We sent it to them, and next thing you know, I think Fonte demoed it first, and then next thing we know, here come a version with Neo on it. And I was like, oh shit. So, you know, now we've worked with Neo. So that was kind of dope. That was kind of dope. And especially to see the, I remember Fonte sending me a video of them shooting his video or his performance. And I was cracking up, man. I was just, you know, that shit was funny. You know, to see the response from the joint. And they like, yo, man, you know, y'all need to do a whole album on him to sound like this. And I'm like, you know, I kind of agree, because Neo sounded really good over the joint, man. I was real happy with how it came out.
Time. Friends, let me tell you about a gadget of mine.
Was it kind of like, you know, Zoe and Tigolo loved the 80s, but just with more features on it? I mean, it doesn't seem like it was much of a departure. You guys were kind of comfortable doing that kind of music already.
Yeah, I mean, it was that we didn't have it in that, we weren't in that mind state. I mean, after the fact, I kind of jokingly was like, yo, man, you know, after all this time and y'all asking for the 80s album, you know, go listen to Time Loop. There you go. But I mean, and what's great about TV and what's great about movies is that it stretches you as a musician, as a producer. You know, musically, I'm able to do something like Time Loop, and I'm able to, you know, do something like these theme songs. You know, the theme music for Sherman Showcase, where you have to cover, you know, early 70s, late 70s, New Jack Swing, and trap music. Like, I did my first trap joint
How about that?
Sherman Showcase theme song, you know, around 2013. So, you know, to be able to mess with these elements, to mess with these drum kits that I normally wouldn't use, which, you know, that's how I came about with Crash. Like, that's why I started working on, you know, I challenged myself to work on, you know, something with the Linn drum for Crash with Cy Smith. You know, I kind of got that idea from working on the Vicky is the Water Warm Enough joint, where, you know, we were doing a parody of Prince, doing the movie stuff and doing the scoring and that type of stuff. Like, it's real dope, man, because you're able to flex in a totally different way, and then you bring that over to your original music, and, you know, it adds another dimension.
This might be kind of on the nose, but Vicky is the Water Warm Enough, piano and a microphone, you being a multi-instrumentalist, Prince has to be kind of a pretty big influence.
100%. 100%. I mean, it was saying a lot when you turned over the album of any Prince album, and it said, you know, produced, arranged, written, composed by, and it's one guy. And it's like, damn, okay. And then you see concert clips. You hear this music, and it's so layered and so thick, and the musicianship is so incredibly on point. And, you know, he had so many tools that he could just pull from at any time, you know, as young as, you know, 18, 19 years old. And, you know, I didn't end up picking up other instruments until I was in my mid-20s. Up until then, it was all piano. I didn't start picking up stuff until maybe 04. And it was just a matter of me just, I went to Guitar Center and bought a bass. I went to Guitar Center and bought some drums. And, you know, the guitar I you know, kind of borrowed, air quotes, from my father. I say borrowed because I took it, you know, just started using it in the studio. And, you know, it really kind of built from there, man.
Well, let me ask you, as someone who is interested in baseball, there are parallels between the business of sports and the business of music. And I wanted to talk about Moneyball with Brad Pitt. Are you a fan of that film?
I don't think I've ever seen it.
It's one of my favorite movies because it's not really about baseball. Like, sure, on the surface level, it's a film about how the Athletics utilize a new way to think about baseball to build a successful team. But when you get deeper into it, I'd say it's a film about finding the value that nobody sees in people that they consider to be worthless. And that is the kind of the theme that resonates with a lot of people. And that theme is probably why this film got made in the first place. Whether it was Fonte's influence or not, like, I would never have imagined to have Bobby McFerrin's daughter on there, or, yeah, you know, then going back to a group that was making hits in the 80s. You're covering a very broad spectrum, and the end result is you have a very diverse project.
Man, I think it kind of goes back to who's listening to our music. Cause I think, you know, even at our shows and things like that, you know, people don't hesitate to bring their parents. They don't hesitate to bring their kids. Sometimes we kind of go off, you know, language wise, but, you know, they have no problem introducing different generations of families to our music, which is incredible, man. Like, you know, to hear someone's father, like, you know, complimenting what we do and say that, you know, it gives them a feeling of, you know, what they were listening to back in the 70s or in the 80s. You know, I've had someone tell me, you know, this reminds me of when I used to listen to WBLS up, you know, in New York City. And, you know, that's a huge honor. Like, that's to me, that's honorable, man, because, you know, these are folks who've been around with the greatest, the folks who we tip our hats to and, you know, who we bow down to. So they've heard a great deal of talent, and, you know, for them to compare the feeling of our music with the feeling that they used to get when, you know, when they listen to stuff in their heyday, like, you know, that's incredible, man. And, you know, then on the flip, to see people, you know, sending in videos of, you know, their kids enjoying our music, or them bopping to our music, or learning the words and, you know, singing it, like, that's crazy. So I think that I think that the feature list kind of, you know, it just kind of embodies our listeners and, you know, just that wide variety of, you know, kind of agelessness.
Yeah, because when we talk about Prince, you know, I don't know if we're talking about the artist formerly known as or Purple Rain versus the Chelsea Rogers or the Third Eye Girl later in life. Because back in the early 80s, right, when stuff came out, you were buying music based off his name. That's what created legends and icons. And the later stuff now, you just hear it on Spotify while you're on the toilet. People used to rush home from school and watch Thriller on MTV. It was treated as an event. So, you know, I don't know if that affects your legacy, because now you have a track on, right, Spotify playlist one week and then it's gone. It's kind of hard to promote music in this attention economy.
Well, I know for sure that I kind of really look long term in terms of, you know, legacy and wanting to have the close to perfect discography and, you know, all that kind of stuff, because I live the same way. And I mean, that's how we grew up. That's how we grew up listening to music. We would buy stuff off of the name. And, you know, I want to keep that a practice now, to where it's like, you know, if you see, you know, Zoe dropping something, like, you know, you got to have it, you know, you got to listen to it, you know, you got to tell people, you know, we're going in the group text with the link, it's here, you know, you got to run it.
Well, let's say you're getting into the business now, like, let's just say, like, now you're breaking in, would you release 4 to 5 projects in the span of such a short amount of time to get buzz? Would that be the most effective way?
That's a good question. I really don't know, man. If it was 4 to 5 projects, it would be very short projects, or it'd be like a single here, you know, maybe every other week or something like that to start getting buzzed. I don't think I would do full projects. I would probably do a single or two every, you know, every other week, this and this and that, so that I'm just hitting you and, you know, it's like getting hit with left hooks over and over again that are effective, to where it's just like, yo, man, where is this dude coming from? Who is this guy? And he keeps coming with these joints and these jams, and, you know, I would probably do it that way, to be honest with you. It's crazy, because, you know, the landscape of music, man, changes literally every 2 or 3 months. So, you know, it's hard for all of us to keep up with it.
That's an interesting observation, because, like, Sunstorm was an hour long, and I think it had a track on there that was like 10 minutes long. And then with Forefront, yeah, we get a more compact audio experience. It's significantly shorter, but it's a bit more visceral.
Right. And it's the same, you know, it was the same practice with Skybreak. Also, I think the two of those are about the same length. We want to trim that fat, man. We want to trim the fat, and you know, we know it's kind of a singles type of industry right now. So, I mean, with that being said, you know, you want to make stuff to where folks don't have to skip shit. You know, let's just put out the center cut music and keep it moving.
Well, if Sunstorm was autobiographical, what's Forefront? I mean, do we classify this album? Do we need to?
Forefront is basically me kind of reminding people of what I do. You know, it still confuses them that here's an artist who is not like singing or rapping. You know, this is not the actual voice that you hear on there. You know, they're still getting used to, for some reason, still getting used to like producer compilation albums. You know, a lot of people think that I sing on the records. A lot of people don't know that I play more than one instrument. They see me live and, you know, I'm playing piano or keys or whatever, and they think it just kind of stops there. So this is kind of just a reminder. It's like, you know, I play different instruments. I'm not singing. You know, I may sing a tad bit live, or, you know, may rap Fonte's verses, you know, when we're live also, but, you know, kind of bringing myself to the forefront, bringing myself into the spotlight a little bit, showing off that I'm, you know, a versatile artist.
Yeah, you do trap now. That's versatility at its finest.
trap theme and trap gospel, apparently.
Trap gospel, I love it. I got one more thing before we get out of here, man, and I got to bring it up, man. Little brother, nod your head if you're going to be on it. I'll take that as a nod. But, man, I would love to see that legacy continue, man. I've been a big fan of yours. You know how people end interviews and they say, hey, tell the people where they can find you.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I do that heavy lifting for you?
I would love it, man. That would be a first.
All right, here we go, man. Zoe35, 3 with a 3, 5 with a 5 on social. In addition to the music, I think something that slips under the radar is he's got threads. Go to zo35.bigcartel.com. He's got new threads on there. Catch him on the road with Carmen Rogers. She's from Texas like me, so you know you got to see them. See how Detroit and Dallas come together and create beautiful music. And if I left anything out, without Zoe hopefully having the correct any information I just gave you, I want you to visit zo.fanbridge.com. And last but not least, if you made it this far into the interview, you're obviously a fan of the man. But what if I told you that you could achieve an even greater appreciation for the music itself? Head on over to vimeo.com/ondemand/makingskybreak. It's an older record, but it's an award-winning documentary. It costs less than a cup of Starbucks, and you get an hour of Zoe. It expands on his background, music, and more. How's that?
Man, I'm going to have you introduce all of our shows, man.
All right, man. Hey, I appreciate your time, man. And congrats on like the new album and everything, man. This is your year, and 2020 is probably going to be even bigger, man. I'm really happy.
Word. Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate you having me on, man. Good to talk.
Yeah, man. You've come a long way from the 17-story apartments with no air conditioning.
How about that?